Welcome to Hope Beyond the Badge, a podcast that brings awareness, inspiration, and conversation together for first responders, families, and others interested in mental well-being and first response. New episodes weekly with your hosts, Jay Bailey and Linda Kokoros. Jay is a father, a military veteran, worked in the fire service for 18 years, and carries a diagnosis of PTSD. Linda is a mom, a wife, a certified life coach for first responders, and a suicide loss survivor of a first responder. Let's talk about it.
John Tamouche is an assistant deputy superintendent for the Plymouth County Sheriff's Office. He's served that agency since 1994. While working as a corrections officer, John developed an interest in crisis negotiations and began serving as a negotiator in 2006. He was appointed as the commander of the Metrolec Crisis Negotiations Team and currently serves as a negotiator for the SEMLEC, or Southeastern Massachusetts Law Enforcement Council's Crisis Negotiation Team. John regularly trains police officers, cadets, and fellow negotiators in the areas of critical incidents and conflict resolution. He's also a military veteran who served in the Army for 7 years. John, I know that that is just a small segment of an introduction for you. There's so much more to your story, and we don't want to leave any of it out. So if you wouldn't mind first just introducing yourself to our audience.
Absolutely. I'd like to thank you both for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to meet you both.
Thank you.
It means a lot, the way you've opened your life to me, and I appreciate that. Oh. So I am at the Plymouth County Sheriff's Office, been there for many years, like it seems like forever, 31 years now. I started in the Army, United States Army, back when I was 17, and not really by choice. Mm. I had no place to live. I was living in my friend was killed when he was young, and I was living in his basement. His mom kind of took me in and became my surrogate mom because of issues at my house that restricted me from staying there. Mm-hmm. So I had nowhere to go. I had no job, nowhere to take care of myself, so I went to the Army recruiter. And he signed me up and filled me full of hope and dreams. And when he actually had to go to my home and get my mother's signature because I was still 17.
Yeah.
And wow. And I wouldn't go back because I wasn't allowed. So went into the military, and it was probably the best decision I ever made. And I always say the best decision I have ever made was to join the Army, and the second best decision I ever made was to get out.
Oh, wow. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into that, all that conversation just there, that those last two sentences that you just said. John, share with us about your family now. Are you married?
I am. My lovely wife is next to me.
Yeah.
Nikki DeFrancesco.
Well, I knew she was married, but I wanted you to tell our audience. Yes. Our audience couldn't hear that.
She's here. She's a little microphone shy.
She's shy.
Yes.
Well, we're gonna work her over in
absolutely
a few minutes.
Better you than me.
So, John, tell us a little bit about that. What you said that was the best decision. Joined the Army. There's so much to your story and so much to your career. Like 30 years in corrections, right? And then there's so much that you do other than corrections. And we're going to get into all that with you. But I want to hit the veteran part of it.
Sure.
In the Army, what made you say that? Like that was the best decision that I ever made, and to go into the Army, and then all the best decision to get out. What's that mean?
So my father died when I was a boy. Mm-hmm. Came home from school, and I was 8 years old, and I found him dead in the backyard. And I always say that was the first day of my life. That's mm-hmm. the day I was truly born. And my mom at the time had no life skills, and she panicked and didn't know how to raise three children. And I forgive her and forgave her for all of her appeared shortcomings from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was 16. I had just turned 17. She was trying to navigate the world, and it was 9 years after my dad died. And she said, you have to go. you can't live here anymore. You're causing too much trouble with her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked up anything I could carry, and I walked out, and I never looked back. Found a place to sleep. I think I had my guitar and some clothes.
Wow.
And hit the road and then joined the Army. And the beautiful thing about the Army for me is I never had a true father figure. Mm-hmm. One of the last memories I have besides his death for my dad was passing him wrenches while he's fixing his car, and he's got a Lark cigarette hanging off his lip, and you know, he's showing me how to turn a wrench, and then he's gone.
Mm.
So I never had a father figure, so the Army really gave me structure. Mm-hmm. It gave me structure. It gave me male figures that I could look up to and aspire to be.
Yeah.
And it also taught me how to learn. In school, I was never a good school student. I barely graduated high school. Plymouth Carver, class of 83, rah. the military taught me how to learn. Mm-hmm. You have no choice. Sit down, learn this. It's time. And I loved the Army. Mm. I loved being a soldier. I loved being part of something bigger than myself.
Mm-hmm.
I loved being in Europe. I loved interacting with other countries and other... just the patterns of life that people have that a lot of Americans never get to realize.
Yeah. So yeah. You got to experience a whole different way of living, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Being abroad in Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
What parts of Europe were you in?
I was initially stationed in Greece. I went to Greece in 1985 and stayed there for 5 years until 1990. While I was in Greece, I got to go to all through Italy, all through Germany. I learned the language. I learned to speak Greek.
Mm-hmm.
I took a test called the D-Lab, which is a military test. It measures your ability to learn languages. I passed that, and I ended up testing in Greek. And
wow.
You have to read, write, and listen. And I became a linguist. So my actual MOS has a LEMA identifier after it for a linguist. And so LEMA Quebec. The Quebec is the NBC specialist. We'll talk about that as well.
Wow. And that's impressive.
Well, it wasn't anything that, it just evolved.
Yeah.
You know? It was easy. I mean, if you want to get the girls in Greece, you got to speak the language.
Yeah, you got to speak the language. Do you still speak fluent?
I do.
Oh, maybe we'll have to introduce you to my husband. Yes. Oh, he's also Greek, right? So
yes.
He does speak and write it and the whole thing. I could not understand any of it. Yeah.
Well, I worked at a pizza place as a second job. Oh, so you had to get as well. So just to practice my Greek.
You had to get used to if you were getting yelled at, right? Mm-hmm. You knew you were getting yelled at in a pizza place, right? Because that's all they do is yell. Well, that's very impressive. I do want to go back a little bit with you, Dom. You know, about your Army career. But before that, you said to me you found your dad in the garden.
Yes.
Can we talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. Like,
how did that, as a child, I can't imagine what that felt like, but you can. What did that feel like to you? What was it like?
So when I came home, I got off the bus and I walked home, and I lived in Plymouth at a apartment complex called Mayflower Village back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the backyard, and I see my father laying on the ground up against the foundation of the house, and there was a little trickle of blood coming from his forehead. And I asked him, I said, Dad, what are you doing? Looking for ants?
Because
that's what I did there.
Yeah.
And he didn't move. And then the next door neighbor came out and picked him up and laid him on the sidewalk. And then my sister appeared. I don't know where she came from, with a pillow. Put a pillow under his head. And they called the ambulance.
Mm.
And the hospital was only 2 minutes away, but it took him about 15 minutes, a lifetime for me.
Yeah.
And in that time of sitting next to my father as he lay prone on the ground, lifeless, I felt an incredible feeling of helplessness. Mm-hmm. And I know I was only 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back, I recognize that. But the feeling of helplessness where I should be able to do something was overwhelming. And it really set the path for my life once I got into the Army and learned how to control myself. Mm-hmm. And once I learned how to control myself, I learned how to control my environment as much as I could, understood what I could control and what I couldn't, reflected back upon the decisions that my mom made, and recognized she didn't have control over herself or her own life, so she succumbed to someone else's will.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an important lesson for me, gifted to me by my dad, unbeknownst to him.
Yeah.
Wow.
Did you find? Yeah, oh, that's powerful, right?
Yeah.
Did you find yourself, like, when you got in the army? I mean, that was like 10 years later, right? You were 17. Did you find yourself between then and the time that you lost your dad? I mean, I can't even imagine you, like, you know, trying even to process that as a child, right? Not only, you know, a child being told your dad is passed, right, is dead, but you're actually finding him in the garden. Between that time, did you said when I got in the army, then I felt I could I had control. I learned how to be able to control myself, what I was feeling. Did you feel that you were out of control in those years, those 7 years, or you weren't able, like, was there panic attacks or was there anxiety from that?
No, it's a great question. No, I was lost at sea.
Lost.
So I just went from place to place, and we moved around a lot. And then whoever was around to hang out with, whether a good influence or bad, I got involved in some bad things. And that was one of the things that pushed me to the military, because I wanted actually to get out of Massachusetts and remove myself from the environment that was going to put me in prison. Or in a grave.
Yeah. Wow. And for you to be able to see that, like, to make that decision, I know Jay can relate with you.
Yeah, that's how I ended up in the military as well. You know, some of the specifics aside, but I was very much lost at sea. I was, and I knew that I wanted to get my life under control, that I was going to lose either my freedom or my life. And that it was very unlikely that I would be able to do that on my own here. And so I went and saw the recruiter, and it was also, you know, if not the best, among the best decisions that I ever made, because I'm quite sure that things were not going to go well for me. By removing myself from this environment with that type of motivation. Yeah, I mean, I went into the military intent to change the course of my life, and I did. So wonderful experience, and I can very much relate.
Yeah, it sounds like the two of you have, like, sort of similar experiences, like looking for structure from the army, right, from the military.
Oh, yeah. I don't do well unsupervised, as my wife can attest to. I really need parental supervision, so when she works late, it's all bets are off. So.
Yeah, you're looking for structure. Well, that's awesome. I love that. Then you came back, right? You came back.
You came back.
You're back in Massachusetts again. Were you back in Massachusetts when you came back?
That's funny. I came back to Massachusetts, stayed for a few months, didn't fit in, struggled because everyone that I knew that was still here had never left. And they're doing the same thing, acting the same way, pumping gas, you're doing whatever, drinking on the weekends, and had no idea what I experienced in the military, the situations I had been involved in. And I really struggled, so I just left. And I went back down to Fort Dix, which was my last assignment, because I still had friends there. And I got an apartment outside of Fort Dix in Wrightstown, New Jersey, and actually Mount Holly, where my second daughter was born, and stayed there for about 6 or 7 months until I got evicted, because couldn't pay my bills.
Yeah.
Then came back here out of necessity.
Yeah. So when did you join the Department of Corrections? Was it after that? Like,
so I came back to Massachusetts and got a job at a pizza place.
The Greek pizza place.
Greek family, and they really, and once the Greeks take you in, unless you break their trust, you're with them forever. And they took me in, and they found me a place to stay, and they gave me money and took care of my car, and I stayed and worked for them, that particular family, and I'm still very friendly with them, for about 9 months. And then from there, I went to the sheriff's department. I actually went to the nuclear plant first, worked security there, got laid off, and went to the sheriff's department, and been in prison ever since. And
you've been in prison ever since, yeah. So tell us about that, and tell us about your Plymouth County, right, sheriff's department. You've been there for what?
31 years.
What was that like? I mean, you're working in a prison, right? So what's that like on a day-to-day basis for what do you call the sheriffs?
Corrections officers.
Corrections officers, yeah.
So you only get it from my perspective. I can't give you a prisoner's or inmate's perspective.
Yes.
So from my perspective, it has unwritten rules. It's very primal. It's very primal. If you break the rules, you're going to get punished in some way, usually by other inmates. And I like that. I like the structure. The structure in prison, no matter what. But the bad part of prison is nothing good happens fast. Nothing good happens fast. So if something's popping off and you know it's usually bad. So you have hours and hours of sedentary lifestyle, looking, listening. And if you don't learn how to entertain yourself by being a voyeur. And I wonder why he's with him. I wonder what this person's doing over there. When something does happen, you're caught off guard. We have a high turnover. But I love prison. I love everything about it. It's time for me to go. I've been there long enough. But I did raise a family. It took care of I'm financially stable. It's a great job. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Once you learn how to relax, just like in the military.
Well, I think that you'd have to be on, like switched on. Like as you said, I have to be watching and, you know, why is he talking to so-and-so over there? Blah, 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 blah. And you have to, is there a scheme going on here? Is there something going to be happening? Is there going to be a big fight breaking out? Like, I'm sure, like, I know you're saying yes, you're dead 30 years, right? So it definitely has its benefits for you, and I'm sure you've gained a lot of experience and knowledge, but there's also lots of bad stuff that happens there that you see, right?
Yes.
Is there death that you see?
Suicides. Stabbings, broken bones, you know, just like in the real world.
Yeah.
Everything that happens in the street happens in prison.
Yeah.
Just the big thing is that there's no place to run when they're coming for you. That's the difference in prison.
And what happens?
You have to deal with it.
Oh.
You deal with whatever threat's in front of you. That goes for inmates or staff. You have two choices, just like in life. You fight. You can't flight.
Yeah.
You either fight or you lay down and die. That's your choice.
So has that ever happened?
I've been attacked, yes.
And how do you deal with that?
You fight until the fight's over.
Until someone comes in and saves you?
Fight till the fight's over.
Wow. And there might not be one person.
It was one-on-one that day. It was just me and him. I don't want to get into war stories. But,
yeah.
And I wasn't even his target. The guy that he wanted to go after wasn't there that day.
Oh.
So he looked at me. He's, I guess you're going to get this instead of him.
Wow.
So.
And how do you deal with it afterwards? Mentally,
it's not that bad because I won.
Okay.
You know, if I had lost, I think it would have been a bit more traumatic. But I didn't. So for a while, you carry a bit more anxiety, I guess.
Yeah.
But there's Edmund Burke said a quote that I read today before I came here, and I actually put it on my Facebook page. It says, the only safety for honest men is to believe all possible evil from evil men. So if you go through life expecting any possible evil from someone, you're not surprised. Because man is one of the most evil creatures on the earth. There's none worse.
So it sounds like, to me, that sounds like I'm just sort of processing that and taking that all in what you just said. But it sounds like to me that I'm expecting something to happen from these people who are all around me. And so I have to be on. To me, that's like being like vigilant, like constantly all the time.
But you can do that without anxiety.
On your game.
You don't have to be amped up. The people who are amped up year after year don't last in corrections because they can't get in a cruiser and go and take a break. You're locked in. We can't get out of our units unless someone else lets us out.
Oh, wow.
So every corrections officer is locked in. And that's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Because the inmates can't leave either. So, but you have your radio. Your radio is your lifeline.
Oh, my goodness. I don't like that. I don't like that.
It's not as bad as...
I don't like that. I don't want to ever be a prison officer. Oh, I don't like that.
We'll do an episode of this in the jail.
My goodness. Oh, that's like totally anxiety for me. Like, my radio is my lifeline. Goodness.
I would never want to be a cop.
Oh,
never.
Wow.
I'd never want to work the streets as a police officer, doing a traffic stop, not knowing who's in the car. Mm-hmm. Not for me. Mm-hmm. I'd rather know that everyone around me is here for a reason. Mm-hmm. 99%. I mean, yeah. There's people that are locked up inadvertently, but
so just for conversation. I mean, I'm sort of getting into that because if you had a bad day at work, right? Mm-hmm. In those younger days, maybe, right? And so, if you had a bad day at work, mm-hmm. how would you unload it? Or how would you get it off your chest? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I would spend money. I would eat, go to restaurants. Mm. I weigh 170 pounds right now. I ballooned up to 275 early in my career. Mm. I was morbidly obese, and that wasn't even drinking then. It was just all food and spending money. Mm. Racked up $80,000 in credit card debt just by trying to, I guess, compensate, have some type of life. But that was early in my career. After about 5 years, you settle down.
Yeah. And then you start to say, I needed to change my way of things. You start to use that as a coping mechanism, right? Yeah. As the eating, the food, that type of stuff. Just started to, hey, this makes me feel good in this mm-hmm. moment while I'm eating it. Yep. And then it's gone.
And it's gone.
And then that feel-good moment is when you go back again for mm-hmm. something else and need it again. Yeah, I understand that totally. So what do you do now, like, for a coping mechanism?
Right now, I have my wife who understands pretty much everything that we both go through.
Share with us why you have your wife. Why does she understand what you do?
She is an assistant deputy superintendent at the facility as well for the Plymouth County Sheriff's Office.
Oh, both of you?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So you're an assistant deputy also?
Assistant deputy superintendent. And
then you're also assistant deputy superintendent. So how many of those is there, assistant deputy superintendents?
It's a handful. I'm guessing about 20.
Oh, 20?
20 for the staff. I think we have about 400 or 500.
Inmates?
Staff members.
Staff members. And how many people are, like, in prison?
Right now, the count's about 600. We've been as high as 1,600. COVID let a lot of them out.
Whoa. Wow. I mean, this is amazing. And the two of you. So the two of you do the same thing. Do you bounce things off each other? Do you find that useful that you can talk to your wife about this because she understands?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I can vent when I need to vent. We have every single day. Hey, tell me about your day. Every single day without fail, and then it's my turn and it's her turn, and after that we become us.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. You can just start to let your day go then. Mm-hmm. Let me talk about your day, and then tell me about your day. I love that. And then just start to let it go and then just go on whatever you were doing. Mm-hmm. Wow, I love that. It's very interesting. Very, very. I really want to pull your wife in, but she's like sitting right back there. She doesn't want to get in there. I know she doesn't.
It's funny because she's quite an accomplished negotiator as well. So I'm a bit taken aback that she
doesn't want to get in. Well, I'm gonna get in and actually talk about that. So let's talk about how you were interested in, because you are. Tell us that title. What you have as a negotiator? What is that?
When I was with Metrolec, I was the commander of the Metrolec Crisis Negotiator Team. I commanded mm-hmm. that team for about 10 or 11 years. Mm. I started as a negotiator with Barry Garrity from Abington PD. He was in charge at the time. Mm-hmm. Barry had duties at the PD. He had to step down but stayed on as a negotiator to tutor me on how to be a commander. Mm-hmm. And then I took over the team, and I was lucky enough to be part of the SEMLEC crisis negotiator team as a negotiator. Mm-hmm. The commander doesn't usually get to get on the phone as a negotiator, but the negotiator does. So on SEMLEC, I got to be on the phone, and on Metrolec, I was in command.
Okay.
So when I left Metrolec, I'm still currently a negotiator for SEMLEC. And it's truly one of the few things in life I would do for free. It's my passion. I feel like it's what I was not born to do, but what I evolved into doing based upon my experiences in life.
Yeah.
And, you know, the highs and the lows.
What made you be interested in doing something like that?
I really didn't understand it at first. It was just a posting at work that said, crisis negotiators, we're looking for negotiators. Mm-hmm. So I put my name in and I got picked back in 2002. And I went to school. I had the first day, September 10th was the first day of school with the FBI. We're in Newport, Rhode Island. And September 11th, the second day of a five-day course, our world changed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then everything got put on hold until 2006 when I finished my training and joined Metro, subsequently Semlec. And anyone can pick up a stick and hit someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can grab a gun or a knife or impose their will physically on other people with some additional mechanism. It's a special connection I don't want to say gift because it sounds like I'm something I'm not, because I'm not, I'm just a guy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something special about being able to talk to someone and have them do something that they initially didn't want to do without violence, without any other external pressure on them. And you create a relationship.
Mm.
And for those 2, 3, 4 hours, nothing else matters in the world but you and him or her.
Mm.
That's all that matters. And it's the world, for me, the world disappears. Mm. There's nothing. It's almost cleansing and exhausting and wonderful and magical and artistic and beautiful. And everything disappears except for the voice on the other end of the phone. It's hypnotic for me.
Mm.
I crave it.
I'm going to get into all that with you in a little bit more detail in a minute. But for the listeners who don't understand, you know, explain what a negotiator does, what a commander does, and what Metrolec does. Like, it's like part of the SWAT team in those big trucks, right? And so I'm just out of explaining that to, but if let's hear it in your words, sure. Like what that is.
So Metrolec, Semlec, Nemlec, Cape Codlec, Semlec with a C from central Massachusetts. They're all consortiums of different towns and cities that give manpower and money. And they have different elements on the team. They might have a child abduction response team. They might have a motorcycle team, canine, crisis negotiators, SWAT, you name it. And they can do a myriad of different functions that a local town couldn't do. We'll use Plimpton as an example. Super small town.
Mm.
If they have a high-risk warrant in Plimpton, they have, I don't know how many, 6 or 7 officers in Plimpton.
Mm.
They couldn't deal with that of their own. But because of the numbers, they would call Semlec because it's a Semlec community, and they would run the high-risk warrant. And that would allow the officers assigned to Plimpton to service their town. So it's a great way for chiefs of police to maintain control over their own areas.
Mm.
They don't have to give it up to an outside agency because they're still in charge.
Yeah.
And then the negotiator's job is just to make contact and
with the individual.
With whoever's there. And why are they? It could be a criminal.
Why are you there? Yeah.
It could be a criminal barricade. Someone robbed a bank, or it's a high risk warrant and they're holed up in their house. Or it could be someone.
Or like a hostage?
It could be a hostage. We've had hostage situations where a gentleman was holding a husband, wife, and a child with a hatchet. So you go and just open that line of communication. And for that incident, he refused to talk to us, so we were talking to the hostage until, after a few hours, the phone was passed over and we had a conversation.
Wow.
And he subsequently realized it was in his best interest to come out.
Wow. How long is the longest a negotiation that you've ever been involved in?
I think the longest one was with Nikki and I were teamed up together, and it was in Dartmouth, and there was a gentleman that refused to talk to us except via text message. So we texted back and forth for almost 7 hours.
Wow.
And he made threats to a local college and demanded money and things of that nature. Had weapons and things in the house. So it was a long time because of the process we used to communicate. But once we got our rhythm, it worked out well because it's just like talking. You try and slow down, not talk over people while they're texting. And that in conjunction with SWAT, creating a perimeter, applying visual pressure when it's appropriate after that relationship is developed. And when, I mean, it's kind of like a TV ploy where they shut the power. But after about 6.5 hours, it was getting dark and the temperature was dropping, the power was cut. And he realized that it's game on. Something's going to happen. And he got scared and ended up coming out.
Yeah. So all the power was cut off in the house where he was or the building where he was. Mm-hmm. And he had no visual. So he knew, okay, they're going to plant something here.
Yes.
And they're ready to come in.
And we stopped talking to him as well to increase that anxiety in him.
Okay.
Because he wasn't suicidal.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that we do. We analyze and we come up with. So years ago, we developed a risk assessment protocol. We have a matrix that we use. We have 14 different elements of information, and we can determine with great success the probability of violence. And for us, there's only two types of violence. Violence to self, which is suicide. Violence to others, which is homicide. Mm-hmm. That's all we care about is violence. Mm-hmm. So age, race, IQ, medical history, criminal history, psychological history.
Is someone gaining all of that for you guys as you're there?
That's all we do. We gain that intel. And even if we don't speak with anyone, we're still going to gain that information. And we come up with a risk assessment. He has a low risk to self and a high risk to others. Mm-hmm. Or a high risk to self or a very high risk to self. And then there's that little subsection that which is suicide by cop. That's its own little section. Based upon, did they call the police on themselves? Did they know, was it an anticipated response? Things like that is indicative of a suicide by cop. So we're very active, even if we don't talk to anyone, because the incident commander is going to look at us and say, what should we do? Should we break down the door? You're going to try to talk to them? And we could say, well, based upon what's been presented to us as of this point, we feel that there's a high risk of suicide. And we don't feel that he's going to, or she, is going to fight with responding staff or responding officers. So it's all based upon our matrix.
Yeah.
We've been very successful.
Well, good. Wow. So being able to negotiate and have them like come out or surrender, right? Is that what the word you use, surrender?
Resolve.
Resolve. We have okay, resolve. Yeah, okay.
It's a resolution.
Surrender. Get your hands up. That's what I was saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny. It's funny the connotations of certain words. You know? Surrender. Who am I? I'm not going to surrender. Mm-hmm. There's another one that was used. Someone said it. We were about to get a gentleman out in Middleborough, and everything was going great. And someone said, take it into custody. So when you take it into custody, and he went crazy. No, I'm not getting taken into custody. So, you know, when this is resolved, you kind of soften things.
Yeah.
You don't lie. And that's the one thing that we never, ever, ever do.
No lie.
We will never lie, at least my team. We will never lie to someone, ever.
Just to share with us why that's important.
You lose all credibility. If you're caught in your lie, that's it. Mm-hmm. Game over. You can't. They'll never believe you again. And that's why we make it a point not to lie.
Yeah.
And if the truth is hard truth, we talk about it.
Yeah. At least you can have a conversation about that.
Yep.
Wow. This is like the movies.
It's like life.
It's like life. It's
yeah.
Like something like that was you'd only hear in the movies. Like for me.
But you do it every day.
How do I do it every day?
At the end of the day, it's a conversation with someone. It's an intimate interaction with a human being that at this moment in their life are overwhelmed for whatever reason. And our job is to figure out what that reason is. Why are you overwhelmed? So they might not even realize it at the time. what set them off, because they're, it's external. Mm. You know, they're mad at their wife, and or they're mad at their boss, or for whatever reason, and they just lose control. And our job is to give them back control and show them that they're still in control.
Yeah. Wow.
And you do that every day. Yeah.
Yeah. Now that you say that to me, yeah, of course.
It's a conversation. Now it's methodical.
Yeah.
It's with intent.
Yeah.
And we're very aware of our word choice and our phrasing.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's a lot of people complicate things when they are first negotiators and they have a monotone, robotic voice, and because they don't want to make a mistake.
Yeah.
But once they relax.
And Nikki's his wife is nodding her head like furiously, like saying, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she is a great case study. When she first started negotiating, she was very robotic, had wanted to do a great job, had a huge, a deep desire to succeed. Mm-hmm. And that's who she is as a person. But it wasn't until she realized that it's a conversation and it's okay for me to say the wrong thing. Mm. I'll ask for forgiveness if I said the wrong thing. My intent wasn't to insult you. Mm. My intent was to learn about you.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, so she's a magnificent negotiator.
Wow. How long are you doing this? How long are you negotiating a negotiator?
I officially 2006.
2006. Yeah. That's a long time. Yeah, nearly.
It seems like yesterday.
18 years.
Yeah, it's gone by quick.
And Nikki, how long are you a negotiator?
11 years.
11 years?
Yeah.
See, we got it to talk. Like, we got it to talk. She's just like nodding and smiling the whole thing.
That's a negotiator trick.
Yeah, she's just nodding and smiling. And but yeah, 11 years, wow. And then the two of you work in the same department also. In the Sheriff's Department, Plymouth County. Wow, this is amazing. Mm. All right. Jay, do you want to say, chime in?
I do have a question. Yes, yeah. Ma'am. So I'm wondering, when you talk about a person being overwhelmed and you're trying to negotiate with them, is it common or has it ever occurred where someone is unaware of exactly what is overwhelming them and they become aware during the course of the negotiation? I guess I'm wondering if that's happened and what that's like.
Yes, short answer to your question. There's a saying, both heaven and hell are located within a man's mind. Yeah. And when I say man, I mean that collectively. Mm-hmm. So one person can have a situation and everything's great, roses and you know, peaches and cream, and then another person has that same situation and the world's going to end. Mm-hmm. So our job is to get that out of their head and hold it in the hand and look at the problem. And we're not problem solvers. We're not problem solvers, and that's the big, I guess, a big mistake that a lot of negotiators make. They try and fix this person's problem. Mm. This person's been dealing with this problem for years. Mm. They didn't wake up one day, and all of a sudden be angry and decide to go barricade. Mm. That's not how it works. So we can't fix their problems, but we can help them vent, to speak about their problems. And when you get something out of your mind, out of that place where heaven and hell are located, and into the open air, and someone else can talk about it, it doesn't seem so overwhelming and fatal.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a podcast where we focus primarily on talking about first responder mental health, right? Yeah. And there's some, like, real duality to this conversation here where there's a person, a human being in crisis, and that's mental health. And then the way that can overlap with the first responders on scene and how that can impact their mental health and really where you are as a person and where you go for sure begins and ends in between our ears,
absolutely,
right? In the way that our ability to understand how to process what's going on in our lives, how to develop and maintain resiliency through those things.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I've learned more about myself by responding to other people in crisis than I could ever have imagined. And if there's one piece of advice I would give to active law enforcement right now, is take the time and talk to people. I know there's a pressure from the chief to go call to call. You know, go to the call, finish the call, next call's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish the chiefs would slow things down.
Mm.
And a lot of them are getting on board and allowing their officers, who are incredibly competent, to take that extra 15, 20, 30 minutes at a call and talk to people and interact on a human level.
Yeah.
And it changes everything.
Oh, makes a big difference.
It changes everything.
Makes a big difference, yes.
And it sets it up for the next call.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, Officer Jones comes in. Oh, he was decent to me. He took his time, and he talked to me last time. I'll talk to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I know that this cop's listening to this, shaking, nodding their heads. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I also think that the difference in what you just talked about there for an officer on a scene, on a call, and if he's responding, I'm going to use the word responding, if he's responding to whatever he's dealing with, whether it be a domestic, just say, right, mm-hmm. for simplicity, a domestic, and it's sort of all hyped up. And then he's able to sort of de-escalate it a little bit, right? And he's just, okay, this is de-escalated now. I'm done. I have to do my paperwork mm-hmm. because I have to get on to the next call, yeah. right? Yep. But being able to, and he's sort of still probably hyped up or hasn't even processed what he took in, right?
Yeah.
And just get shoved back and not talking about it because that's my job and I'm meant to do this and this is what I'm hired for. And it could have been traumatic, right, for him. But we don't know because it's shoved back down there and he's getting ready for the next call. But to take that little moment, you're so right, to take that few minutes, right, to be able to have a conversation and allow himself also to be able to come down.
And find inner resolution.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a great point.
Yeah. Like to be able to sort of just de-escalate and come down off that as well.
Yeah.
Right? And process it. Okay, that was a tough one. Or I'm okay. And being able to just think about it before they go on that next call. I think, the chiefs are, well, it all depends on what department, right, it is, right?
Sure,
there is chiefs that are sort of definitely on board with it, you know, we had a couple of calls this week that are tough calls. How are you doing? Right? Or maybe their stress team or someone on the stress team will reach out to them and say, how are you doing after that? And then there's other departments, no, they're not doing that. But it's beneficial for them to get on board with that because it's better for the officer. It's better for the community because if that officer is not... has come down and he's gone now to the next call and he's hyped up from that last call. Mm-hmm. It's not in the best interest of the next call that he's going to.
Right.
Exactly.
For anybody involved. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
An institution is the extended shadow of one man. Mm-hmm. So when the chief is on board, that mindset trickles down very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It really does. And I'm so lucky. We're so lucky. The chiefs involved in Semlek are amazing men, profound thinkers, progressive. And the preservation of life and peaceful resolutions are always their primary goal. And not to say that it's not for other chiefs. I'm not inferring that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the guys that I work for are special. And it makes me want to succeed. That's why I redouble my efforts and my training, and I'm always reading.
Oh, that's awesome.
Always trying to learn.
Yeah.
Because they hold themselves to a high standard, and
they're going to hold you to a high standard too, mm-hmm. right?
Not only that, you want to hold yourself to their standard because you want to succeed for them.
Yeah,
because they're going out of their way for you.
Yeah,
you know, and the best commander I had in the military was the guy who put his men first. His mm-hmm. men ate first before anything.
I'm relating with that. I can hear you saying, yeah.
I am, absolutely.
And he taught me that old adage, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a colonel and in charge of the unit in Greece, and he got in trouble all the time. But he took care of his men, and we would have done anything for that man.
Yeah. Mm.
Anything.
Your loyalty stayed with him.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he earned your trust and the belief. He fostered a belief in you that he was going to be there for you.
And you nailed it with the word trust.
Yeah.
You have to trust up and down the chain.
Yeah. I believe that's also in departments, the higher-ups, right, the administration. I think they also have to, develop trust within the men and women who are working for them. Because if there isn't, if there's no trust, there's no belief, right? And if there's no belief, well, then there's just going to be all lost and in limbo. And who do I turn to if I need to? And, you know, we say all the time, Jay, if a first responder went to get help and he was struggling maybe off that last call and it just didn't sit with him right, and he went to get help and someone else is looking on and he sees this guy getting help and coming back to work and he's starting to be well again and he was supported by his department, right? This guy looking on is going to believe that or have that belief that if he needs some help, well, then he's also going to receive it too because he just witnessed it and this guy is coming back and he's doing great. But on the other flip side of that, if someone goes and gets help or seeks support from the department and they're not, they don't get the support and they're ridiculed or, you know, there's some retribution going on there. Well, and the other guy looking on is going to say, yeah, I'm never going to ask for help. I'm keeping my mouth shut because I need my job and I need my paycheck and I'm just going to suck it up the way I've been sucking it up even though I'm struggling and whatever else it's manifesting at home, right, in his personal life. And it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. But for dear life, he's not going to go and ask for help within his department or even talk about it within anybody in his department because he's going to feel like he's going to get the same that other guy got. You know
absolutely.
What I mean?
And that's, yeah. That's that extended shadow of the one man.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, yeah.
I mean, think of the type of person that gravitates towards police work.
Mm.
The personality is usually a little higher energy, I guess, for the most part. I don't want to come out and say alpha males, but a little bit more inclined to interact and confront. So when you have all the strong personalities, that's what we'll call them, strong personalities. When you have a group of strong personalities, you have to allow them the space to be strong. And when they're not strong, you have to support them. Because they have a deep-seated desire to be strong. But we can only stay at a certain level so long before we crash, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And that's why I know I'm so lucky, because I have my outlet at home.
Yeah.
That keeps me sane. It really does. I wouldn't have been in the position I am in life in general if it wasn't for my wife.
Yeah.
And my girls, so I got two older daughters.
Yeah. So I'm going to say your support system, right? Your
exactly.
support system.
And that's one of the risk factors when we look at suicide and homicide is support system. Mm. Oftentimes when people are barricaded, it's because they lost that support system.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens to officers when they don't get the support from the higher-ups.
Yeah.
When they need it, they lost that support system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because administrators and chiefs, whether we recognize it or whether we like it or not, are part of any first responder's support system,
yes.
even when it's lacking, right? Because they, as we're talking about, it starts at the top. They have influence on the way that their department does the job, interacts with the public or, in the case of prisons, with the inmates. And I think what we were talking about a few minutes ago ties into this part of the conversation as well, because our thoughts, our behaviors, our beliefs, and our actions, they contribute to one another. They lend themselves to one another. And our attitudes trend.
Yes.
The way that we interact with the public, if we're going through, and where does that purpose lie in the resolution? Most people that gravitate towards this work, they do it for reasons that are sort of intrinsically good, right? Mm-hmm. And when you develop a method of interacting with whomever you're responding to that is aggressive in nature but gets it done and then the paperwork's done, what begins to happen with you? And then that goes home, and then that becomes part of the departmental culture.
Yes.
And then, you know, the opposite side of that is very true as well. I think that administrators and chiefs and true leaders, where they're present in those places, have a real opportunity to influence their department in ways that matter.
Yes, and it's actually intangible, the good and success that they can have.
Mm.
Because they're going to have an agency where people don't go sick. There's less sick time. They don't have use of force incidents out during during calls. So it's almost a negative that you have to measure. And it's much more difficult to measure a negative to work in that. And the thing that I see is that no one lives their life in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. I do my 8, hit the gate, and I leave my job at work. That's BS. That doesn't happen.
Right.
It doesn't happen. You can tell yourself that all day long. No one works in a vacuum and then goes and lives their life. So if you realize and accept that I'm a human being and I respond to other human beings that are in crisis, why can't I be in crisis?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't it be my turn?
You're human.
Why can't I get support and everyone come out and want to bring me to the hospital? And is it because I'm embarrassed? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because it's going to ripple through my entire career? Possibly. But the big thing I see is peer support is huge.
Yeah.
And two things I want to say. Don't ever hesitate to engage in conversation with a brother or sister, ever. Except if you don't have the time to commit. There's nothing worse than say, hey, how you doing? Oh, not good. Oh, I'm sorry, bro. Hey, I got to go. I'm off shift.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than that. So if you open that door.
There's no validation there, right? No. If you don't commit.
Yeah, no, we just walk through it. And so it happens for me at restaurants, at bars, out at the beach. You know, you say.
You find yourself talking to people?
Yeah, my wife has coined a nice term. She calls it picking up strays. It's something that I gravitate towards because in, 10, 15, 20 minutes, we're sitting there at the bar and we're both crying and we're hugging and exchanging mementos because just shared with me something that brought him to drink alcohol in the first place.
Yeah.
And now he's there crying and it happens. It started to disrupt us a little bit, so I toned it back a little bit. We started to sit at tables instead of bars.
Compromises, right?
Yeah. But that's what I mean. This is one thing I would do for free.
Yeah.
There's something for me that draws me to that human intimacy.
You're picking up energy.
Yeah.
From whatever that feeling that you get, right? You're picking up that energy, that vibe that someone's like, And it just happens organically, I'm sure, right? Yeah. It just happens, and, you're not expecting it. It just happens. I know that feeling, too.
Yeah.
Right? I do know that feeling.
Yeah, people want to be heard.
Yeah, people want to be heard. And sometimes it's just an ear, right? A listener. Mm-hmm. Someone, good listener, is all that they need sometimes, and they end up just letting it all out.
And you just touched on the secret to being a good negotiator. Is being a good listener.
A good listener.
Negotiators don't talk people out. No one can talk someone out. You listen someone out.
Oh.
And it's a total mind shift. It doesn't matter what I say. It matters what I hear. Mm-hmm. And I confirm what I heard.
Yes, absolutely.
That active listening. I understand.
Yeah.
But you know, and if I don't, then help me understand.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I totally get you. I get you. So I want to get into something a little bit deep with you.
Right.
I want to talk about October 29th, 2018.
Yep.
It was the day we lost Alex. For the listeners, it's our son, Alex, who died by suicide in October 29th, 2018. Tomorrow is actually going to be his birthday. Would have been 41 tomorrow. So it's ironic that you're here in the studio talking with us today. So that day, when you were called out, share with us a little bit about that day. Because I know we had some of Alex's buddies in on an interview last year.
I listened to it.
Yeah, they did a sort of... a memorial, like a memory thing for Alex, right? They wanted to pay tribute to him, and it was his 50-year anniversary. And then John, just for the listeners, just out of the blue, although Father Sean said to me when I was just telling him that you had reached out to me, he says that there's no out of the blue. That wasn't a coincidence that he reached out to you. That was God doing that for both of you. So tell us a little bit about that day, because you as a negotiator, you were called in. And I didn't know anything about this, so there's some stuff that I'm going to hear for the first time.
I was in command of the team that day, and we got a call for a barricaded male suicidal in Marshfield. Marshfield, correct? And we were told it was a police officer. So we've had barricaded police officers in the past. Not many, but there's been a few. And it's a whole different approach to negotiating with a police officer. So when we arrived, the first thing we try and do is gather information. How did he get to this point in his life? Or her? With Alex particularly, what happened? And we learned about the personal issues that he had going on. And we, the big thing is with us is to make contact. We call any phone that we have. Is it a landline cell phone? We try and get family members' phones and try and text them or call using a family member's phone. At least we have the phone, and we call it capture. We've captured the phone in case they call, and then we can pick up and talk, and then we'll deal with the aggression. Well, why do you have my mom's phone? I mean, we can deal with that.
Yeah.
As long as they're talking. You can be mad at me all day long. But with Alex, it was probably, not probably, it was the second hardest call I've had. Because of, it was the hardest emotional call. Tom was there, and some other friends of Alex's that I hadn't met before that Tom introduced me on scene. And what got me was the uncertainty in their eyes and their body language and their mannerisms, their nervousness. And I think they knew that Alex had already killed himself. But we're hoping, we're just holding on to that sliver of hope. Everything from the negotiator's perspective, based upon what we learned, location, we talk about as well. How important is the person's location to the situation? It's indicative of violence as well, or not. And I tried to keep, tried to show as much respect as I could for the entire situation and what they were going through. I tried to be compassionate for them because this is their friend.
Yeah,
this isn't a subject to them. This isn't a call out for them.
Yeah,
this is their life.
Yeah,
and
someone they knew.
Yeah, someone they loved.
Yeah,
and I didn't want to forget that, and I tried to keep them informed, and I went back to them 3 or 4 times. Anytime something developed, I went, I would go and try and get information, maybe something that we didn't know yet, that if the phone was picked up, that we could use that to try and open a line of communication. And the hardest part for me in calls like that is, and it could be from a position of arrogance or overconfidence, but if I get them on the phone, I think that they're going to live because there's still a little ambiguity there on life or death. And if someone will talk to me, I'm confident that I can find a connection. And just, I don't want them to die today. It's not today.
Yeah.
You know, tomorrow's a different day. We'll deal with tomorrow tomorrow. Let's just deal with today. And for me, it was hard because I didn't have that opportunity with Alex. And the more... it got harder for me weeks after because I started to learn more about him. People called me up and told me the type of guy that he was. And the emotional pain that he carried with him based upon the family stuff. And and the more I learned about him, the harder it became. And then I have that Semlek CNT Facebook page. And I think you friended the page, and it just and I was actually hesitant,
not knowing that you were.
And I wasn't gonna message you because I didn't know, I didn't want to offend. You know, you had already been through enough, and why should I open any wounds that aren't mine to open? Mm. So I was very cautious, and I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I wrote that little paragraph about 17 times and tried to make sure that I was compassionate. And you responded shortly thereafter, and I think the next day we had a two-hour conversation.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
It was wonderful, and I felt... I can't say that I had been carrying around with me, but I did feel lighter. I did. Mm. I felt happier.
Yeah.
You know, it was really wonderful.
Well, the thing was that what it sounds like to me is that you were carrying, as you said, you got to know him, where a lot of times you had shared with me on the phone that you don't remember some names, right? And you remembered Alex and another gentleman.
Yep.
And that, you know, looking at the anguish of Alex's peers, his buddies, his friends, you know, that didn't leave you for those 5 years. You were carrying it around for those 5 years.
No, it stuck to me like bad cologne. Mm. You know, the anguish that they emanated, it was just seeping from their pores, mm. you know, their pain. And that's the old saying, suicide doesn't stop the pain. It just passes it on to someone else.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
So they absorb that, and we all absorb that.
Mm. Yeah.
But this is, I was thinking a lot about what you're doing now mm. and the process, I'm assuming, of self-healing and the journey that you have now, which
yeah.
was completely different from what it was before 2018. Mm-hmm. And I was torn initially because I was thinking, well, is it a good thing to have someone who committed suicide memorialized in that way? So maybe someone else who's thinking about suicide will actually commit suicide because, oh, hey, maybe they'll do that for me too.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about that. But then I started seeing what you're actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
And your primary goal is to open the lines of communication for people before it gets to that. Get the help. Mm-hmm. Talk to people. Help your brother. Help your sister. don't be a person in the stand. Mm-hmm. Don't just watch the show from afar.
Mm.
Get involved in it. And I know that you're doing good things. You're changing people's lives for the better, and I know that. And I'm really proud and honored to be here with you.
Oh my goodness. I'm like, I'm trying to like be whole in my emotion, and I'm sort of smiling here, but I just want to say to you that I was so glad that you did reach out, because I had so many unanswered questions. And we didn't even get into it. I didn't even need to get into it, because I just felt like I could breathe a little bit by hearing, you know. I didn't even need to ask you that conversation, because you had said to me, if I had talked to you in general, you said just like what you said there, I know if I got to talk to make a connection with a person, they're not going to die that day. And I knew then, without even asking you, that you didn't talk to Alex that day. And he was already gone.
Yeah.
And you know, because I would have had lots of more questions if it had been the other way around, like, you know, and I'm sure you would have, you know, had a lot more kept inside, losing someone. After you have a conversation, yeah. And so I... we're not going to get Alex back, right? His memory. I know. I have a totally different relationship with Alex now. I know he's still around us,
yeah.
And we just don't see him, but he is here. And but the beautiful thing that you did was to be so compassionate to his peers. And I know they don't forget that, because they were the ones that were left hanging, right, at the end of it all, within a department that was totally dysfunctional at the time. So, you know, they possibly weren't going to get the support that they needed. And, you know, still 5 years later, last year, right, in October, 5 years later, they got on the podcast and for the first time they shared amongst themselves really what they were going through. And, right, Jay? And it was sort of, it ended up being, instead of like a, it ended up being like a peer support group.
It's like a debrief.
That evening. Yeah, like a debrief of that evening. And then one of them saying, you know, in light of what we're talking about, I'm not okay and I need help.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. But I know they mentioned you and I didn't know who you were, didn't know anything about you. And they did mention you, that the compassion. I remember them saying that the compassion that you showed to them, towards them, was just unbelievable. And they were forever grateful because they felt supported by you and validated by you and heard by you. And I don't know what conversations you had with them, but I know that they felt that.
They they helped me as well, because they gave me a direction to go in. They mattered.
Yeah.
They mattered.
Yeah.
And they mattered to me. Mm. And it gave me something to do, because so many times we don't know what to do. We'll call this, call that, text this, trying to get more information. But they gave me a direction where I could put my energy as well to try and keep them in the loop and keep them informed, because they were the most important people at that time in my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I was the commander. Mm. The negotiator, Alex was the most important person for the negotiator that was assigned that day. I don't even remember who was assigned as the primary that day.
Mm.
But I actually looked for the report. I think they moved it.
Yeah, but they did move it.
Yeah. So, that being said, yeah, they, there's something I always say, funerals are for the living. You know, wakes are for the living.
Mm.
And the day that I was there with Alex, the living
were the ones that needed you.
Were the ones that needed me.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you. They needed you that day. Yeah. And you were there for them.
Yeah, and they needed each other.
Yeah.
And that's why they was like a little, sorry, they never left.
No. They still have that little circle.
Yep.
And they'll still come together, and for every birthday, for every anniversary, they all get together and they remember him and they tell funny stories about him, and they, you know, if it's his birthday, they'll do a little cake. Yeah. Again, knowing that he's still there and watching. And you know, and they share all those funny things. And, you know, they're very, very involved with, you know, what we do, and very supportive of it and share all of that. We started to do, you know, the first year that Alex passed, we were going to invite some of his, it was like his, he died in October, so it was maybe the March right after, was going into that. And I think the first year was a blur. I don't even remember if it was a year gone, but I remember we were having some of the guys over for his birthday. And I knew they were struggling, as we all were. Still are. Some of our family are doing better than others. And we wanted to have them over to have something to eat and a few drinks. And I decided that I wanted to have something meaningful. And I got a blanket kit, and we were going to propose to, like, all make a blanket together. And I didn't even say it to them. I was like, are they going to feel like foolish, like sitting there making a blanket with me, you know? But it was, the purpose was to start healing together. Yeah. Our family and them. And COVID hit, and it all threw all that idea down the drain for a while. It postponed it. And then a couple of years later, you know, here we are. And now we're making blankets monthly. We started the AGK Memorial Fund last year. We've been raising funds. Abington that made donations, and then I do a little fundraisers here at the cafe. And finally, we were able to sort of have enough money that if we're going to start something, I'm not going to start something if I can't sustain it. So I waited until we got enough stuff, money in there, and said, okay, we're ready. And so literally January was our first one, right, Jay? Yeah. For our family to sort of all put that together. And we reached out to the community and said, come help us make these blankets for first responders to offer them comfort when they're going through some challenging times. And literally they came out in the droves. We had 60 people that first night. And we bought all the blanket kits. So from the AGK fund, we're able to buy all these blanket kits, and it's no sew. So if you ever want to join us on a date night, you can join us and make blankets. And then On-Site Academy are the recipient of those blankets, where they help first responders start on a healing journey. And we're very, very proud to be able to do that. And they're called Hope Blankets. And in this, hope is healing within. Optimistic for the future, the power of positive self-thinking or talking, and embracing where you are now. Yeah. And, you know, first responders struggling, they can't heal from where they were before, or they feel they I'm going to get better and then I'll start working on myself, or I'm going to fix this. But they can't from where they were before, because they're changed, right? Chemically, your job of trauma changes you. So, you know, they can start healing from where they are now when they accept that I'm struggling.
Yeah.
And start moving forward to be able to heal from there. So the blankets are a symbol of that, a symbol of comfort in memory of Alex. And there's a little card that goes in the bag with him. And every first responder that goes there for a 5-day residential stay will receive one upon arrival. And they get to use it while they're there. And then they're making a connection with that blanket.
Yeah.
And then they get to take it home with them. And I suppose, inspired to continue on their healing journey and get back to work and get back to reality and start feeling themselves again and be able to do what they need to do. But that blanket's always going to be there.
Yeah.
As a reminder of, you know, how they were able to come through some dark times. Mm-hmm. And so we're very, very proud of those blankets. And then that led to the podcast, and that led to the family readiness workshop that we just put on last week. And we had every organization, you name it, there. It was absolutely amazing. I think one of the gentleman from Semlik was there, Kevin Harrington, was there with his comfort dog, or the comfort dog Nola. But we had On-Site Academy, we had a leader program at McLean, we had 4 or 5 trauma therapists there, we had equine therapy, we had mindfulness coaches, we had financial coaches, we had also, and they all got up to present. And the whole purpose of it was to be able to have first responders and spouses be able to attend, because usually the spouse doesn't know what's going on within work, right? Because they don't want to put on trauma or burden them with what the gory details, right? So they don't talk about it at home. And I'm sure the spouses don't know about all the different offerings that there is, and support and resources that's available to them. So we wanted to connect those families directly to the resources, so that in a time of need or a time when they're going through struggle, instead of the wife saying or the husband saying, which vice versa, You need to talk to someone, and I don't know who to call. Who do I call? And it may be a crisis situation in the home. Instead of that, they were going to leave. They all left with a folder with all the resources in it to take home with them. So that in a time of need, they're saying, I talked to that person, or I met that person. They presented and I like what they had to say. I'm going to go in that folder and I'm going to be able to have a phone number here that I'm going to be able to call. So that was the whole purpose of that, was to be able to sort of maybe educate a family member about those red flag signs that they might see, like that we didn't see,
sure,
right, with Alex. And maybe if we had that, we probably would have been able to guide him to a little bit more resources that was available, or maybe have a tough conversation with him.
Yeah.
You know, to say, what's going on here? And we weren't aware of that. And police officers and law enforcement, right, good hiders. They hide things very well.
Sure.
And so, you know, he was also a good hider. He didn't let us in to a certain extent. So that was tough on me because I was the one that was having conversations with him every when he was home. He was living with us at the time. And I was the one that was having conversations with him, sitting out on the deck with him, you know, till late at night. And having like full on in-depth conversations. That conversation never came up, you know.
The conversation about suicide?
Yeah, never came up.
What do you think that is?
Well, I didn't address it. I didn't see it in him. I knew he was down and I knew he was very sad over what was going on personally in his family life. And also the stress of work, right? So there was lots of different combinations of things that he talked about with me. But suicide never came up in the conversation. I don't know why I never brought it up. I never thought he would do that because his kids were everything to him, you know? I never thought he would take his own life. His kids were everything, everything to him. And that's all he talked about was his kids. And so even afterwards, I was very mad at him and angry and confused because of that. Like, that kept on coming into my head. Why? Why couldn't you talk to me about this? Why leave your kids? Mm. They meant so much to you. So they're still the things that when I get a chance to talk to them someday, they're the things I'm going to be asking them, you know, for sure.
Have those difficult conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. Have those conversations. Jay, you chiming in there?
No, I'm just kind of honored to like be a compassionate witness over here at the moment.
Yeah. Go ahead. But you don't know how much having this conversation with you means to me. I have no words to express.
I think I'm getting to know Alex through you, which is nice. Like I said, the more I get to know him, you know, the more I move forward.
Yeah,
as well. Tough conversations. It does sound like you still blame yourself a bit.
Oh, I feel I could have seen it, you know. I could have seen. If he had let me in, that little bit more to say, I don't want to be here anymore. If he had to give me one inclination or used a word that would have been a red flag to me.
A terminal,
to dig a little bit deeper on it, because I am a prober. I probe. It's just I listen to words. I'm big on hearing words, and that stand out to me. And there was nothing that stood out to me with the words he was using.
He was probably protecting you.
Yeah,
is what I would say. Yeah. He was probably just, I don't want to put that burden on my mom. It's not her. It's not her weight to carry. It's mine. Mm. And he probably thought he was protecting you.
Mm. Yeah. A lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of us, you know, feel the same. Police officers too. Yep. You know, having lunch room the day before. You know, and feel they missed it. You know, how did I miss it? All of those type of things. And there still is lots of unanswered questions that I have for him. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And, you know, the day that you called me or the day that you messaged me, I was like, whoa. I was taken back, you know, and having the conversation, I was taken back right to that day and sort of relived the whole chaos in our heads. I'm praying. Constantly praying, making our way down to Marshfield that day. And then when we got there, you know, we could see one of those, I don't know what you call that truck, that big, huge,
mobile command.
Yeah, the big green thing, right? I call it like the SWAT team truck, right? I saw that pulling out of the estate. So I knew, even though we didn't know until we got there, but we knew that was like, well, what's going on? So we didn't know what was happening. We didn't know he was gone until we actually got up to the area. Yeah, which was devastating, to say the least. Was that the only police officer that you've ever, you know, negotiated or had an opportunity to negotiate with? No,
we've had two or three others.
Yeah, over the years,
over 18 years.
18 years.
Yeah, there's been a few. Some that were former police officers, and some that were still active.
Yeah,
different reasons. Some were medical, in nature. Others were, you know, they just never learned how to deal with their anger. And that constant trying to control their environment. I mean, and we all know, and this is preaching to the choir, with when it comes to police officers, they have to control their environment. Their life depends on it.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to mental well-being, emotional well-being, sometimes you have to surrender. You have to, I don't want to say give up, but you have to surrender to the fact that you're human. Mm-hmm. And that maybe when you go to that domestic, you were actually afraid and you have to hide that because you have to immediately control and have that image of confidence.
Yeah.
I'm here to quell the situation. And after, if you have the luxury of being able to talk about it, you know, and say, dude, I was scared, you know, out of my wits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you have that confidant that said, I was ready to, I thought I was going to catch one that day, whatever, however you do it. But you have to surrender and you have to trust that if you're ridiculed because you show that you're human, your humanity, your emotions, and someone ridicules you or treats you different, that's a them problem. That's an issue that they have that they're going to carry with them to their grave.
Mm-hmm.
I'm human. I love the fact that I can get my feelings hurt and recover from that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a process. It takes time. Mm-hmm. It may take years, depending upon why and who hurt me.
Yeah.
But I would never give up that pain because that's made me who I am.
Mm-hmm.
All the issues. I mean, look at you, Linda. You're and I mean this sincerely. You're amazing. You're doing things because of your pain.
Yeah. It's healing for me.
Yes. Mm. And you surrender to it, and I have to, all right. And you let that pain wash over you, and you feel sad, and that's okay to feel sad. It's okay to feel frightened. It's okay to feel anguish, and don't fight it. Don't hide it. Embrace it.
Mm.
Embrace it.
Allowing yourself to be vulnerable.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
And grow.
And if you can find someone that you can be vulnerable with, all the better.
Yeah.
If you can't, then call me.
Yeah. Call me.
Call me.
Yeah.
You know?
What would you say to a police officer or a first responder? Not only, we talk about first responders in general.
Sure.
What would you, advice or guidance would you have for a first responder who might be struggling?
The same advice that I would have someone who's not a first responder, because they're all human beings. There's no difference. Strip away the uniform. Strip away the job. The job is of no consequence. The job is a source of stress.
Yeah.
But in the surrender phase, in the reparation of my soul, when I've been hurt, it doesn't matter what I do for work. That's all put on a shelf.
Yeah.
We're talking, brother, how did you get to this point?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter what they do for work. It's all about their humanness. It doesn't matter if they're a trash man, if they're homeless and have no job. It doesn't matter.
So what would you say to someone who's struggling?
How did you get to this point in your life is the first thing.
Yeah.
You know, what happened? And then you go from there. And if they respond, then I have something to work with.
Yeah.
It's none of your business. Well, forgive me for prying, but I'm just trying to understand how you got to this point in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
You know,
it's a conversation.
Yeah.
It's a conversation that you have and I want to have.
Yeah.
I crave, like I said, there's something, I don't know how I developed it or how, if it was genetic, from whoever. But I crave that emotional intimacy.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't matter who it's with. It could be Joe Bag of Rags that just got locked up, or it could be President of the United States.
I think that you are born to be doing this.
I evolved into this, absolutely. Yeah. The path of my life led me to that telephone.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah.
You know? And
I feel that. Do you feel that, Jay?
Yeah, I do.
Feel his whole energy, his whole thing going on?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You were born to be doing what you're doing and to be helping someone get through, or maybe just not die that day.
Just not that day.
Just don't die that day.
I can't. We don't go there to fix problems like we talked about.
Yeah.
Why are you here?
Mm. Well, I could just sit here across the microphone and say, hey, you can go on out for your dinner date to Nicky. I could just sit here and have a conversation with him. Just like, it's like he's touching my heart. He's touching my soul. I feel it. Every bit of it, when he's sitting there for the listeners, when he's talking about the vulnerability and surrendering, he has his eyes closed and he's like meaning every word that he's saying. And he's probably just even blocked us out that there was no one there, but he was just saying those words, feeling them, right? Feeling every word that was coming out of him. And it's just amazing to hear you speak. And I know that Semlik and I know Metrolek were lucky to have you. And now Semlik, are you still working in Semlik? They're lucky to have you, you know, on that team. Being able to sort of negotiate with someone who is in crisis, and if there is, and you get to talk to them, I know they're not going to die that day. So thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for coming in tonight and talking with us this evening. I am honored. I am truly honored.
As am I.
To have you here and have this conversation. I feel a connection with you, and I think we're forever going to have a connection. From the time that you sent me that message, we're forever going to have a connection.
I would like that.
Yeah, for sure. Well,
John shares with us about his childhood trauma, including losing his father at a young age, and how those events and other circumstances propelled him into a rewarding military experience. John also shares with us about the 30-plus year career he enjoyed following his military service, working in corrections. He describes the primal nature of a prison environment, talks about prison violence, a time when he was attacked by an inmate, and how he used food as a way to cope with the stress of his job. John was curious when he saw a posting at work for a course in negotiations, so he applied and opened the door to discovering his ultimate purpose as a crisis negotiator. John shares with us the many roles he's had as a crisis negotiator and commander, and how he's used those experiences to train others in how to resolve crisis. John also details a number of incidents that he's responded to, and shares openly with Linda about the hardest emotional call that he's ever been to. On October 29th, 2018, John responded to a crisis involving Abington Police Sergeant Alex Kokoros. John and Linda have a compassionate discussion about that day and about Alex. John shares how he met Alex's friends on scene, how he could feel the anguish radiating off of them, how it became more difficult in the weeks that followed Alex's death as he began to learn about the man that he was in life. Alex was loved. John says that after meeting and speaking with Linda, he feels lighter about the events that unfolded that day. And as for Linda, she believes that no two paths cross by accident, and her and John's connection is forever. If you're a first responder who's struggling now, or if you're having thoughts of suicide, please know that help is available. You can call one of the Hope Lines at 781-817-3357 or 617-657-9000.
9108, and we can guide you to helpful resources.
Till next time.
Till next time.